This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Nabil Biagio, and here's what's coming up.
So as we stand on this sacred and scarred earth, a record of our collective grief and a monument to the memories that live on in us each day, this is the legacy we must carry forward.
That's Jill Biden, the First Lady of the United States, on 9/11. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. In Cameroon, officials say weeks of flooding along its northern borders with Chad and Nigeria have swept away entire villages, leaving thousands of people homeless. Aid efforts are underway, with many schools, mosques, and churches providing temporary shelter. But aid groups say the needs are greater than their resources, as Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for Mokolo, Cameroon.
Heavy rains fall in Mokolo, a business and agricultural district on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. Cameroon officials describe Mokolo, which is also the capital of the Mayochanaga administrative unit, as the breadbasket of Cameroon's northern border with Chad and Nigeria. Haman Adama is the spokesperson for people displaced by floods in Mayochanaga administrative unit in Cameroon's northern border with Chad and Nigeria. Adama says hunger looms in Cameroon's northern border with Chad and Nigeria after floods in August and September destroyed sorghum plantations in Mayochanaga and neighboring Mayodenai, Mayosava, and Jamare administrative units. She says the impacts of the ongoing floods will be felt up to March 2023. If heavy rains continue to make it impossible for farmers to return to their plantations for the new planting season that begins in October. Adama said several thousand civilians are seeking refuge in schools, hospitals, churches, and mosques in towns and villages not threatened by floods. Aid groups and humanitarian agencies are providing food and medical supplies to civilians who have lost their houses, plantations, and animals to the flooding. But aid workers say they are unable to meet the growing needs of displaced civilians. The government says the heavy floods are in part caused by seasonal rains and waters from the nearby lakes Chad and Maga. Cameroon says a regional approach with Chad and Nigeria is needed to reduce the damage caused by floods. Christophe Bring is the head of Department for Studies and Projects at Cameroon's Environment Ministry. Bring says during Africa Climate Week in Libreville, Gabon, from August 29 to September 2, African nations, the African Union, and the United Nations made commitments to foster a common African regional climate action. Bring spoke via the messaging app WhatsApp from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé.
La semaine africaine du climat de Libreville est donc une opportunité.
Bring says during the climate week, African states identified causes of changes in regional climate patterns, proposed sustainable responses, and prepared a common strategy to reduce the effects of climate change. He says Africa's position will be presented to the world during the United Nations Climate Change Conference, known as COP27, that will be taking place in Egypt in November. Bring said the ongoing floods in northern Cameroon are caused by heavy rainfall resulting from tropical weather disruptions, deforestation, and improper agricultural practices. He said thousands of families have gone homeless because they constructed houses and settlements in flood plains. Cameroon officials say the northern border area with Chad and Nigeria hosts about 550,000 IDPs and about 70,000 Nigerian refugees. Some of the displaced persons include civilians who fled conflicts over water between cattle ranchers and fishermen. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Mokolo, northern Cameroon.
Five people died in an attack on a convoy of an opposition senator in southeast Nigeria. Police today said the dead included two security personnel. The gunmen ambushed the convoy of Senator Ifeanyi Ubah of the fringe opposition Young Progressives Party in Anambra State on Sunday, opening fire on the vehicles. Ubah escaped unhurt. Police officials say two other police escorts were wounded and were taken to a hospital. It was the latest violence in a region where separatist tensions are rising. Southeast Nigeria has seen a surge in violence the government blames on the outlawed indigenous people of Biafra group IPOB or its arm wing ESN. IPOB, which seeks a separate state for Igbo people, has repeatedly denied responsibility for violence in the region. In Senegal, chaos broke out in the National Assembly as newly elected members argued over who to elect as the Assembly President or Speaker. The dispute, in part, rests on demands by opposition parties to bar voting by members who also serve as state or cabinet ministers. Journalist Alpha Jallo has been at the National Assembly in Dakar all day and spoke to VOA's Kate Pound Dawson about the developments.
Yes, following the election, the legislative elections last month, the 31st of July, the newly elected members of parliament, the National Assembly, as they are called, should have been installed today. And this is their fourth day of duty. And they were all summoned, and they all came on time because the order of the day business started very early. But then there was a lot of disagreement, I mean, during the process. And it took almost for a very long time, even order could be restored.
I understand things got rather hectic today. Can you describe some of what went on?
Things got hectic this afternoon here. When the business started at the National Assembly, there were heated, you know, arguments between the two opposing sides, and which even resulted to an instant, you know, to physical fighting. There was an instant about 15-20 minutes. It was just like a wrestling contest because most of the newly elected members who were arguing that they should not allow state ministers who are also newly elected members of the National Assembly to participate in the vote. That means to participate in the vote which will elect the speaker or what they call here the president of the National Assembly. It took a long time before order could be restored at the National Assembly this afternoon.
So at this point, they have not yet selected the president for the National Assembly. What happens next? How long can this process go on?
Well, I can tell you that this is going to be an all-night debate because it's not they're supposed to elect the president of the National Assembly, and also they're supposed to elect, you know, the parliamentary groups. And I understand that there are about four parliamentary groups because the ruling, the coalition, which has just a simple majority. This year, you know, the first time in the history of the country, the National Assembly got balanced, so that you see that the ruling party got just a simple majority by one vote. So you have 80, you maybe have 82, 83. But I can tell you that it is going to be a very, very, it's going to be an all-night long debate. So
that was Alpha Jallo reporting from Dakar. He spoke with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson. Many academics and social commentators say Africans should use the death of Queen Elizabeth to reflect on the enduring physical and mental effects of British colonialism. The United Kingdom, of which the Queen was the figurehead, was one of the great imperial powers. It colonized much of Africa, including today's continental economic powerhouses of South Africa, Kenya, and Nigeria. Darren Taylor reports.
African politicians spent the weekend showering tributes and compliments on Elizabeth, who ruled Britain for 70 years. It's expected that leaders from the 21 African members of the British Commonwealth will attend her funeral. Thousands of Africans have used social media to pay their respects to Elizabeth, with many tweeting that she was the Queen of Queens. Lebogang Peko is a social researcher and political economist at the African Trade Collective think tank, which focuses on pan-African issues.
The very fact that we say the royal family, the queen, centers that as a form of, I guess, white normativity and British normativity, that there's the one monarch and then all others are subservient to that. And I think that we should reflect on what this means for us and what that says about us and the imprint of colonialism on our psyches, in our languaging, in our vocabulary.
Peko points out there are many kings and queens in Africa, but none as revered as Elizabeth was.
It's also almost impossible to get away from historicizing the role of the British royal family in previous and ongoing atrocities. So, I mean, for example, the Commonwealth, which is the vestiges of former colonized states. And it really does seem to keep on enforcing the notion there must be a center and that that center is a British imperial center.
One of Africa's biggest trade partners, Britain argues it's done much to atone for colonialism. Every year it provides billions of dollars in aid and investment to the continent. That's great, says Peko, but the UK government and royal family have never apologized for their country's toxic history of slavery in Africa. She points out the UK used resources from its colonies to build what's today the fifth largest economy in the world, and it was all done in the name of successive kings and queens.
They extracted about $47 trillion during the colonial period just from India alone. Every time one sees the late Queen of England, as it were, wearing that crown, remember the diamond that was stolen in South Africa, which is worth $400 million US. And there haven't been any conversations whatsoever about when these jewels are going to be returned. And they're just taken as being owned by the crown. They are stolen goods. So whilst I appreciate...
Peko says the Queen's death is a reminder that many Africans aren't free from the chains of colonialism.
We can't really get away from how far-reaching this imprint is. It goes beyond the fact that so many of our own suburbs here, even here in South Africa, across Zimbabwe, across Swaziland, Botswana, Nairobi, bear these very British Anglophile identities. Queen Elizabeth Bridge, for example.
She says she doesn't buy the argument that Elizabeth and other royals could not have at least condemned the horrors committed in the name of their family.
The crown has a lot of power, and I don't think that we should act as though they're just these little wax figures that are sitting inside Madame Tussauds, helplessly smiling and waving. They certainly have voice, and they certainly can wield that voice.
Many across Africa now want the new king, Charles III, to be that voice, to have the courage to issue a formal apology for British imperial atrocities that happened in service of the crown. And, says Peko, maybe it's time for the House of Windsor to also return a few African diamonds. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. On the 21st anniversary of the September 11th attacks on the United States, Americans gathered to mark the date and mourn those lost. Marcus Harton has the story.
President Joe Biden laid a wreath Sunday at the Pentagon just outside Washington, where 184 people were killed when a hijacked jet hit the building. He acknowledged the grief experienced by families of those lost and pledged to keep the United States vigilant against future attacks.
No terrorist could touch the wellspring of American power, and it falls to us to keep it safe on behalf of all those we lost 21 years ago, on behalf of all those who have given their whole souls to the cause of this nation every day since. That's a job for all of us.
In New York City, Vice President Kamala Harris and her husband, Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff, attended a ceremony at a memorial plaza where the World Trade Center Twin Towers once stood.
Jaime Concepcion.
Albert Conde.
Families read aloud names of the victims, pausing for moments of silence at the time of day when airliners struck the two towers, claiming nearly 3,000 lives. Diane Massaroli's husband, Michael, worked on the 101st floor of the North Tower.
Oh, he was the best person ever, best dad, best father, best husband, you know, hardworking, loved to bowl, just like an awesome. That's why I go every year and I hold up his picture, even with people that never knew him, just to know him and remember his face, and because he was a life, you know, that was worth something.
My cousin, Louis Joseph Nagy II. Joey.
At the Flight 93 National Memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, First Lady Jill Biden spoke, reflecting on the airline passengers who brought their hijacked plane down, thwarting an intended attack on Washington.
So as we stand on this sacred and scarred earth, a record of our collective grief and a monument to the memories that live on in us each day. This is the legacy we must carry forward. Hope that defies hate. Love that defies loss. And the ties that hold us together through it all.
Other communities around the country conducted observances, including candlelight vigils, interfaith services, and other commemorations. Marcus Harton, VOA News.
The Global Fund is seeking $18 billion to save millions of lives in the fight against HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria. The fund, which is made up of governments, multilateral agencies, and other stakeholders, says over the past 20 years, more than 50 million lives have been saved from the three diseases. The consortium will hold a replenishment conference hosted by U.S. President Joe Biden next week in New York. The French news agency AFP says spokespersons for the global partnership say the new funding, which covers funding through 2026, could cut death by two-thirds and save 20 million lives. Health experts say progress in fighting the three diseases has been hampered by the COVID-19 pandemic, food shortages caused by the war between Ukraine and Russia. They say malnutrition weakens the ability of afflicted people to fight disease and respond to treatment or prevention efforts. The fund says, however, that a rapid scale-up in programs has allowed the treatment to recover lost ground and further its aim to end the three diseases by 2030. A report presented at the opening of the 51st session of the UN Human Rights Council paints an alarming picture of growing abuse and violence in all regions of the world, with few rays of hope for a peaceful resolution. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Acting High Commissioner for Human Rights Nada Al-Nashif highlighted the growing desperation of millions of people trapped in a never-ending cycle of human rights violations, violence, and political instability in dozens of countries around the world. She addressed the worsening situation in numerous countries in Africa, including Burkina Faso, Burundi, the Central African Republic, and Mali. She offered a rare glimmer of hope regarding the nearly two-year-old conflict in northern Ethiopia's Tigray province.
Following the recent resumption of hostilities in northern Ethiopia, I am encouraged encouraged by the announcement yesterday by authorities in Tigray of their readiness to abide by an immediate cessation of hostilities and to participate in a robust peace process under the auspices of the African Union. I urge the parties to take immediate steps to end the violence once and for all and to opt for constructive and genuine dialogue.
She dwelled at length on the unbearable levels of violence and human rights abuses by heavily armed gangs in Haiti. She called on the international community to help contain the scourge of violence in that country. However, she made only passing reference to China's incarceration of more than a million Uyghur and other Muslim minorities in so-called vocational centers. This is despite growing demands by human rights activists for a special debate on this issue at the Council.
On 31 August, my office published its assessment of human rights concerns in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of China with recommendations to the government and other stakeholders.
Acting High Commissioner Al-Nashif was more robust in her criticism of Russia's actions aimed at quelling domestic opposition to its war in Ukraine.
In the Russian Federation, the intimidation, restrictive measures and sanctions against people voicing opposition to the war in Ukraine undermine the exercise of constitutionally guaranteed fundamental freedoms. Pressure against journalists, blocking of internet resources, and other forms of censorship are incompatible with media pluralism and violate the right to access of information.
Al-Nashif said the war in Ukraine continues and the suffering of the civilian population continues. She noted the serious socioeconomic consequences of the war also persist. This, she said, has resulted in severe fuel shortages and threats to food security in some of the world's poorest countries. She added the devastation caused by the war in Ukraine will be discussed later in the session. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The French news agency AFP says three UN peacekeepers were injured by a roadside bomb in northern Mali yesterday. The UN stabilization mission to the country, known as MONUSMA, says the vehicle hit an improvised explosive device along the 8-kilometer road between the villages of Ber and Timbuktu. The international force, which was established 9 years ago, has more than 17,000 troops, police, civilians, and volunteers. AFP notes that more than 175 of the troops have died in attacks by extremists, more fatalities than any other peacekeeping operation. U.S. President Joe Biden has named a presidential delegation to attend the presidential inauguration of William Samoei Arap Ruto tomorrow in Nairobi. Catherine Tai, United States Trade Representative, will lead the delegation. Its members include Meg Whitman, the U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of Kenya, and Colin Allred, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from the state of Texas. Kenya is an important U.S. ally. In 2021, Biden announced that he'd sent American special troops to Kenya to help with counterterrorism efforts. In December, Ruto and other 50 Africa leaders are expected to join a U.S.-Africa summit in Washington. For the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of engineer Joe Gill and producer Nadia Faha, thank you again for tuning in and for choosing The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all, and it's happening